This is Steve Sherlock with another Franklin Matters radio show, number 333 in the series. This session shows the 4th District Candidates Town Hall, facilitated by the Franklin Area Against Racism and Medway Marches groups, that was broadcast by Franklin TV. The forum was conducted via Zoom to adhere to the social distancing requirements of this pandemic period. Angelica Crosby, Raj Selam, and Justin Bates moderated the forum, providing time for each candidate to respond to the questions on a random rotation. All Democratic and Republican candidates were invited. Photos of the event participants, including screen captures of the questions in response order that were shared via Twitter, are available in the Google Photo album linked in the show notes. The recording ran just about an hour and 40 minutes, so let's listen to the 4th District candidates discuss their positions on a series of issues.
All right, Angelica, you want to get started?
Sure. Hello, I'm Angelica Crosby, and I identify as a cis female. I'm an island-born Puerto Rican married to a Black man, and together we have 3 biracial children. I co-founded Medway Marches, a local community group dedicated to creating an inclusive community for people of color in suburbia.
Hello, my name is Raj Selam. I identify as a cis male. I'm an Indian American. I'm married to a white woman. We have 2 biracial children. I'm also a co-founder of Medway Marches.
And hello, my name is Justin Bates. I'm white and identify as a cis male. I am co-founder of Franklin Area Against Racism, a group focused on invoking change behavior through dialogue and community outreach. We thank you everyone for joining us tonight. We're looking forward to this dialogue. I want to thank you to Raj and Angelica for your help, effort, energy. This is going to be a really great night. Also, I'd like to thank Franklin TV for partnering with Franklin Area Against Racism and Medway Marches to hold this event. So tonight, candidates from the 4th Congressional District race from 7 to 8:40, 7 Democratic candidates, and from 8:40 to 9, 1 Republican candidate, will answer questions posed by you, the residents of the 4th. All Democrat and Republican candidates were invited to this town hall. Chris Anetos was unable to make it, and Julie Hall did not respond. Our hope for tonight's event is to provide the opportunity for 4th District residents to understand how our candidates feel about race, racism, and systemic institutional racism, and how they plan to take substantive action within Congress. How this night will work. As moderators, we will ask questions that are either directed at specific candidates or questions that will be answered by all candidates. In your answers, we ask candidates to provide real, substantive policy ideas, personal and emotional connections, and again, real policy, that real policy focus. The questions and order of the candidate responses will be posted in the chat and has been determined by a random number generator. The amount of time each candidate has to answer the question will be shared after the question is posed. If a candidate goes over their allotted time, a moderator will step in. Let's begin. Candidates, please introduce yourself, stating your name and pronouns. Becky Grossman, we will start with you, and I'm adding the candidate order in the chat right now. Let's get started.
Good evening, I'm Becky Grossman. I'm a Newton City Councilor and I use she, her pronouns.
Alan.
Good evening, my name is Alan Casey. I'm the co-founder of City Year. I identify as an Italian Iranian male. My pronouns are he, him, his.
Jesse.
Thanks for having me tonight. I'm Jesse Mermel, she, her, hers.
Jake?
Hi, thanks for having us tonight. I'm Jake Auchincloss, he, him, his.
Okay, Isan?
Hey, good evening. Thank you for having us. My name is Isan Leckie, and I am she, her, and hers.
Okay, and that leaves you, Dr. Natalia.
Hi, my name is Natalia Linas, and I use she, her, hers pronouns. Thank you.
And Ben Siegel?
Yes, thank you. I'm Ben Siegel. I'm a proud Puerto Rican Latino, and my pronouns are he, him, and his.
Okay, let's begin. This question is for all of you. Racism and systemic racism manifest itself in America in many different facets of life. Healthcare, education, financial systems, criminal justice, housing, etc. If you could propose one bill, just one bill, that would solve one of these specific problems for the BIPOC community, which issue would you prioritize and why? Each candidate will have 2 minutes to respond. Ben, we will begin with you.
Thank you, Raj, for that question. I think one of the underlying reasons we have for systemic racism actually interconnects all of these systems that we have seen systemic racism within. And so I think there's actually one thing we can do immediately that would help all of this. And that's, no one is born a bigot. No one is born a racist. No one is born an anti-Semite. We teach that in our society. And so my plan is to unteach that and to teach our youth at the earliest ages, beginning in preschool, kindergarten, first grade, second grade. And as a father of four young kids who are all from high school all the way to kindergarten, I know this really well, but we need to teach our youngest that lies, stereotype, prejudice, they can turn into hate and far worse death. We've seen that. At the same time of our education system with our youngest, we need to also re-educate and unteach our adults what they've already learned. And so we need cultural competency and diversity training, implicit and explicit bias training to all of our leaders, religious, civic, and education leaders up and down. I just heard 2 weeks ago when I was talking to a teacher in the district that 2 weeks ago was the first time she's ever had diversity training ever in 25 years of teaching. We can correct this. We know that we can stop this through education. Education is the antidote to racism. And there's many other ways, but you've asked for one major way, and that's educating our youth from the beginning and educating our adults now so that we all understand we're all in this together and we're all interconnected.
Thank you, Ben. Becky?
Thank you. I think it's really important to start by understanding the intersectionality of each of these topics that you raised and how they all come together in the realities of systemic racism. But since you asked me to pick one, the one that I would focus on is universal pre-K and affordable quality childcare. As a mom to two young kids, my kids are 9 and 6, I think through the lens of kids, the future generations, and we know how the inequality in society begins right at birth in terms of the childcare opportunities that families have or don't have, and in terms of what those early years of education look like and how each dollar that we invest in those early childhood years pays dividends as a child's life goes on. If we are going to tackle systemic racism, I think the system of education, how we treat education in this country, and looking at it through an anti-racist lens to ensure that Black and Brown families have the same opportunities that I know that my kids have the privilege to have here in Newton is going to be absolutely essential to making progress.
Thank you, Becky. Natalia?
Raj, I entered this race because I was looking at the death rates disproportionately impacting Black, Indigenous, and people of color, Latinx communities due to COVID. As a social epidemiologist, I knew that this is what we would expect because all diseases do emerge along the fissures of our society reflecting discrimination and marginalization. And health is a place where you see it manifests so obviously. You know, in New York City, I worked at the health department and we had maternal mortality rates 3 times higher for Black moms than for white moms. The same was true for infant mortality. We saw premature death for Black and Latinx communities, you know, 10 years premature compared to other white Americans in New York. And the same is true here in the District 4. You know, a wealthy neighborhood in Newton has a life expectancy that is 26 years longer than some of the poorest neighborhoods in the South Coast. And that is just unfair. But my solution really is that we need to fundamentally address this issue. You know, 400 years of slavery, Jim Crow, our legacy of redlining and our policies that the federal government put in place, and that can't be treated through a Band-Aid. We need to have a conversation around reparations. And I'm proud to be the only candidate that has reparations as central to my platform. I believe that that is the adequate response to the harm that we have seen and we have done and the ongoing racism that is there. And as you said, it's playing out on every single facet, but until we're able to admit to what we have done in this country and to actually call for true reparations, to address the fact that a Black family in Boston has $8 of net worth, whereas a white family has $250,000, we will simply not be able to close the gap. So my bill is a foundational one, and it's around reparations. Thanks.
Thank you, Natalia. Jake?
Housing, I think. Housing is work that I've done over the last 5 years in the city council. I've seen how it intersects with racial justice. And the reason I point to it at the federal level is because I think it is so deeply intertwined with three issues that are so problematic in our country right now. One is wealth creation and transfer. One is education, and the other is transportation. One of the great contributions that Elizabeth Warren made in her presidential campaign was putting forward a really robust federal housing policy that would not have just used carrots, but also sticks to get states and cities to build more housing and have more inclusive housing. I think if you do that at the federal level, we get a couple of follow-on benefits. One, we could try to start redressing our legacy of exclusionary zoning and redlining that has deprived Black and Brown communities of the ability to create wealth, transfer wealth between generations, which is a massive driver of inequity today, not just income inequality, but also that wealth inequality. Number two, it would promote much more equitable educational opportunities. As all of us know, here in Massachusetts and in most places in the country, educational quality is tied to property taxes. And we can't talk about inclusive education without talking about inclusive housing policy. And a robust federal program to build more housing throughout the Commonwealth would help redress some of those imbalances. And finally, transportation. One of my mentors in transportation policy, Jeff Speck, oftentimes says that the best transportation policy is land use policy, meaning that if you're serious about fixing bad commutes and making basic amenities more accessible, you've got to get your land use right, meaning more missing middle housing, more mixed use development, better infrastructure for cycling and walking around those housing projects. And so if we can build more mixed use, more missing middle housing, a lot of the transportation challenges this state has had with its concomitant public health and environmental degradations will actually be ameliorated because we're going to have more walkable neighborhoods with stronger social fabric. So I would go for housing, because of how it intersects with wealth creation, how it intersects with education, and how it intersects with transportation.
Thank you, Jake. Alan?
The fight for racial justice has been a central cause of my life. My friends and I invented City Year more than 30 years ago and started in Boston because of Boston's history of racism. We wanted to show that national service, bringing young people together from all different backgrounds, could be the meeting place to build common ground and complete the civil rights movement. We changed the laws in the 60s, the Voting Rights Act, the Civil Rights Act, but you only change hearts and minds through experience. What I would recommend to do, and you're right, this is all intersectional. After the brutal killing of George Floyd, Reverend Cornell William Brooks, past president of the NAACP, and I jointly proposed the creation of an American Truth, Justice, and Reconciliation Commission. We suggested that we had to recognize this extraordinary awakening that has happened, with estimates of 30 million people peacefully protesting now for more than 75 straight days, including in Franklin with 1,000 people on the green. How do you take that energy and make sure that it leads to major legal policy and cultural change? So we said there should be a federal commission, I've served on two of them, chartered by Congress, with $50 million, led by moral leaders like Bishop Tutu was in South Africa, people like my friend Brian Stevenson, who's taught us all that you have to be proximate, or Reverend William Barber, or Mayor Mitch Landrieu, who I'm honored is supporting me in this campaign, who was the first to take down the Confederate statues. Thankfully, that's happening all over the country. But would be charged with recommending transformational policies, not just in police reform, but in criminal justice reform. in public education reform, because the average cost per student in Fall River is $14,000, in Dover it's $25,000. That's fundamentally unfair. Public health reform, because we're seeing that with the coronavirus, it's attacking more people of color.
Thank you, Alan. Asan.
Thank you so much. We all know that racism has been embedded in the history of our country through slavery, through taking away the land of the indigenous peoples, and through more. It has made itself so prominent, not only in our policies, but also in our daily lives, that we all are prone to racism, no matter what racial group we feel we belong to. I was born and raised in Morocco, North Africa. And back then, I didn't know the true history of my country. I learned of that history when I came here as a 20-year-old with nothing, exploring a new world that promised freedom and promised dignity for all people. And I learned that I came from a country that was the funnel for slavery, that was the hub and a market that sold human beings to Europeans and to the US. So I understand the struggle, but I also understand that as an immigrant, I saw a different type of struggle of being othered, of being uncounted, of working poverty wages, of being denied healthcare and housing and a bank account. And that struggle is intertwined with our BIPOC community. I still say I will never understand deeply how a single mother who is Black is sending her son across the street to get candy and he never comes back. I will never understand that struggle. But I rely on building a multiracial, multi-generational, multi-ethnic movement to fill my blind spots.
Thank you, Asan. Jesse?
You know, it is exactly because of what you pointed out, the intersectionality of all of these issues, the ways in which systemic racism has seeped into every facet of American life, that I understand my job as a congresswoman will be to look at every single piece of policy that crosses my desk through a racial justice lens: education policy, housing policy, transportation policy, healthcare policy. But if I could lift up one particular piece of legislation, one particular policy area that I think addresses multiple pain points when it comes to systemic racism, it would be paid family and medical leave. When you think about the ways in which our failing, crumbling healthcare system contributes to racial disparities in this country, when you think about the failures that we have in this nation around economic inequality, making it easy for families to accumulate wealth and creating a safety net for people when they go through hard times, and the disproportionate ways these failures impact Black and brown individuals and families, paid family and medical leave is a way to move the needle on those issues. And I was so proud to be on the 8-person team here in Massachusetts that negotiated what is now the strongest paid family and medical leave law in the country, addressing racial inequity and gender inequity and economic inequity by making sure that if you go through the natural ups and downs of life, starting a family or getting sick, or God forbid someone you love getting sick, you can take the time off to deal with that without fearing financial ruin. And that is particularly important for Black and brown communities in this nation that have been left behind by our failures around healthcare, our failures around economic inequity, and our failures around wealth generation. I want to take the muscle that I have built around paid family and medical leave, take it to Washington, and fight to tackle racial inequity with this important policy.
Thank you, Jesse. We have a follow-up question on that one, and we'll go in reverse order this time. If Joe Biden loses, you will likely have to work with the Republican Senate and executive to pass your bill. What aspect of your proposed bill that you just talked about are you willing to compromise on? Each candidate will have 1 minute to respond this time. Jesse, we'll start with you.
So paid family and medical leave is incredibly complicated. I know that from spending 7 months with my sleeves rolled up working on those negotiations here. there are areas where we can compromise. And we went through that process here in Massachusetts, negotiating the number of weeks, negotiating the employer-employee payment split. But when we walked into those negotiations, me sitting on the same side of the table as social justice organizations and labor, we walked in with some core principles that we weren't willing to compromise on. But at the end of the day, working families, our BIPOC neighbors, people who are just working to make sure that they're living in dignity and supporting our families could do that through the policy that we were creating. So yes, there are ways that we can negotiate around the edges, but there's no way I'll negotiate on the core principle of using paid family and medical leave to tackle racial, gender, and economic inequity in this country.
Thank you, Jesse. Hassan?
Yeah, thank you very much. I thought that the first question deserved 2 minutes, so I'm going to take up more time to explain myself, because as a woman of color, in order to share with our community my lived experiences and how they relate to the policies that we're fighting for, I do require more time and equity for time. So I'm fighting for the Green New Deal and for Medicare for All and for getting corporate money out of politics. And these are the bottom line. We cannot negotiate beyond what constitutes the basic human necessities to live. And when it comes to our Republican colleagues, I understand that at the center of what we're fighting against is corporate money. Whether be it Republican or Democrat, it's corporate money. And that corporate money has no room in this campaign. We will be able to pass the policies that we need that are anti-racist. But anti-racist policies aren't going to get rid of microaggressions, aren't going to get rid of our own sense of racism against each other. And that's something that we're gonna need in our communities, and I have been organizing across the district to have the difficult conversations so that we can educate each other and move on forward to a better society. Thank you.
Thank you, Hassan. Alan?
Trump wins, we're gonna have to have a massive resistance effort in this country. I was very involved in building the Women's March in Boston, the Sister March Network, March for Our Lives. I actually believe that because of the awakening that's happening, we can overcome. I believe this proposal that I've made with Cornell William Brooks, and that Congresswoman Barbara Lee has made a similar proposal, and if elected, I will follow her leadership. We can actually get it done, even with a Republican Senate and even with Trump, because 70% of the people now have recognized Black Lives Matter. When it was first proposed, people said all lives matter, it was dismissed. We have to figure out how we can take this extraordinary energy that's in our streets and use it to break open the doors of Congress. I've done that successfully in the service movement. I beat Tom DeLay and the entire Republican government when they tried to kill AmeriCorps, and I beat Mitch McConnell when he opposed the tripling of AmeriCorps in the first 100 days of the Obama administration. This can be done if you know how to take this energy and use it to get Congress to act.
Thank you. Jake?
In the last month or so, Trump's HUD secretary has rescinded affirmatively furthering fair housing, and Trump himself has tweeted nakedly racist remarks about how he's not going to allow suburban moms to have low-income housing next to them or something like that. So if he's reelected, we're not going to get a housing bill passed because this president has no interest in an inclusive country and has no interest in using housing to redress racial injustice. But I had mentioned that housing intersects with wealth creation, education, and transportation. So there would be two ways that I think we could still make progress on those fronts, even if worst case scenario, there was Republican-controlled Senate and White House. One is a higher estate tax, higher inheritance tax that could be used to fund a baby bond, basically, so that extreme wealth was not passed generation to generation, but was rather spread out more evenly across kids who were being born with no opportunity. And secondly, carbon pricing with the dividends being used.
Thank you, Jake.
Natalia.
So I talked about reparations and making a moral case and also just a fundamental case for reparations. And obviously that's a difficult push, even with the Biden administration, and under a Trump administration, even harder. I do think that it's important, despite those difficulties, to be pushing, because the public is where we need to change the minds and hearts. Right now, over 70% of Black Americans believe that reparations is the right way forward, but a much smaller percentage of white Americans. I think that is fundamentally a problem, and we need to move forward. But, as others have said, what would you push for? I would push for, I would still talk about reparations the way I talk about them now, highlighting the inequities in health, inequities in wealth, inequities in every attainment as why we need this fundamental change. But I would maybe be open to starting with community investments. You know, individual transfers might be a harder thing to push for, but building healthy communities and vibrant communities is part of my platform. And I think that would be.
Thank you, Natalia.
Becky?
So the priority that I had identified is affordable childcare and universal pre-K. There is nothing that would make me trade away our kids' future or compromise on our kids' future. And when I talk about the urgency, passion, and commitment that I bring as a mom to this race and to Congress, that's exactly what I'm talking about. And why I believe that if we had more than 25 out of 435 members of Congress who are mothers of school-aged children, this wouldn't even be a question. Affordable childcare and universal pre-K, these are logical, straightforward, needed, overdue changes. And I'm going to fight every day to make those a reality. And I think that Republicans and Democrats alike understand the crushing costs of childcare and the need for pre-K, and that we're going to find common ground to get this done because we know what it's going to mean for our kids' future. And I'm.
Thank you, Becky.
Ben?
Yes, thank you for this question. And especially when we have to understand we can't be all in or nothing. We have to find compromises. And so for me, the compromise is not that we need to educate our kids about lies, stereotypes, and prejudice at the early ages, and that we have to educate our kids about Black history, not just during Black History Month or Hispanic Heritage, not during just Hispanic Heritage Month, but how much are the incentives going to be in carrots that we're going to give to schools and to states in order to teach this curriculum? That's what I'm willing to compromise is how much are those incentives? The same with our public boards and our private boards and executive suites. We know we need them to immediately have bias, explicit and implicit training, as well as cultural competency. But what are the carrots that we're going to give? That's where the compromise is and not what it is overall.
Thank you, Ben. Moving on, this was alluded to by a couple of you already. HR 40 is a bill proposed in Congress which would establish a commission to examine slavery and discrimination in the U.S. from 1619 to the present and recommend appropriate remedies. This commission would identify the role of governments in supporting the institution of slavery, various forms of discrimination against African Americans, and the consequent negative impacts. Do you support HR 40? And how would you propose America in 2020 make reparations to the African American community? Each candidate will have 2 minutes to respond. Ihsan, we'll start with you.
So thank you. As I mentioned before, you know, I'm a true supporter of reparations because I understand that when we cause trauma and hurt and pain in our communities, it's our responsibility to acknowledge that that pain has been present and to then go into repairing the damage. We will never make people forget poverty. We will never make people forget racism and the implications of it on their lives. But we can make up for some of that pain, at least through policy, through making sure that they have everything that they need from healthcare, from a good paying job, from a business, and to also pay them back, literally pay them back for the losses in their lives, which is why, you know, one of the issues that I support and fight for is legalization of marijuana across the United States and also expungement so that those people who have been wrongfully imprisoned be let go and then giving them the resources to make up for that lost life, making sure that they get firsthand when it comes to marijuana businesses. And these are going to be Black communities and these are gonna be communities of color who have been incarcerated wrongfully. So, you know, this issue of the overall racism in our country is not about one policy or one bill. We need an anti-racism resolution. just like the Green New Deal resolution, and then under it, build multiple bills and policies that are going to make up for this hurt in our communities. Everything that I support on my website and go to esan.org/issues to look is embedded in anti-racism, from domestic policy all the way to international policy. And no matter, even when I was told, look, this is a majority white district, why are you talking about racism 2 years ago? I said, look, we are a united district. We are a district of solidarity, and we care about every human being the way we care about our own children. And
thank you, Hassan.
Ben?
Yes, thank you. And I just also want to make sure we just thank Franklin Area Against Racism for putting tonight's forum together. Since we didn't have opening statements, we didn't get that chance to thank all of you. This is such an important conversation. I absolutely support HR 40, but I think we have to do it through investments in our community, our Black and Brown communities. And look, I'm the only Latino in this race. I would be the first Latino ever elected to Congress from Massachusetts. You know, that's a real underlying issue of systemic racism here, is the lack of diverse representation. But we need to invest in our Black communities and transportation. We need to make sure that all of our communities are getting proper transportation that's efficient, that's affordable. They've been without that. Look at Fall River and Taunton and the South Coast, without the South Coast Rail and so many other things. Education, we need to make sure that we're getting away from our education budgets depending on property taxes. And we invest substantial resources into the schools that need it most. We need to provide more financial resources for our students when they're virtually learning. 10% of our students under COVID-19, mostly who are Black and Brown students, don't have internet, and 20% don't have devices. We need to give them the resources in order to have that. I also believe in a cap and trade program with a high carbon tax underneath that at $50 a ton upstream to all our fossil fuel companies. And so 80%, if not more, of that money needs to go back into our Black and Brown communities, because we know we need to combat environmental racism and injustice. And that money needs to go back into those communities that have been having the burden of the climate crisis more than anyone else. It is the same with housing as well. We need to update and modernize both our public housing and our low-income housing. We need more low-income and middle-income tax credits. We need more housing choice vouchers as well. This is not about diversity. This is about equity right now. So it's not just about being invited to the game. It's about being playing in the game and giving the proper tools.
Thank you, Ben.
Thank you, Ben. Alan?
Thank you.
Yes, as I mentioned, I proposed a similar idea. And I do support it. And the reason I believe in this is that we have to figure out a way to take this protest energy and lead it into a federal process that will actually lead to significant change, including economic justice change. What's encouraging to me is that in response to the brutal killing of George Floyd, attitudes about race and recognizing we need to deal with our historic system of racism have completely flipped. 70% of the American people are now ready to deal with it. It's at the top of the polls in terms of issues that people want to confront. And so if you had this commission traveling the country, holding hearings led by moral leaders, people would be able to come. We have to tell the truth and then charge it with justice. That will lead to support for, I believe, community reparations. And we need to have specific policies. So I have proposed Restore the Dream accounts as a way to deal with the wealth inequality. Natalie is right about the wealth gap. Outside of Boston, across the country, the average Black family has $17,000 in assets. The average white family has $170,000. That is specifically tied to our history of racism from slavery to Jim Crow to redlining. So what I've said is take $15,000 for every young person when they're born, paid for by the estate tax from the wealthiest people, put it in a safe account. By the time they're 19, it becomes $50,000. It'd be used for the American dream. The way a young person gets it is do just 1 year of national service. Instead of mortgaging our young people's future, I want to jumpstart them with $50,000 in the bank. If a family gives just $500 a year, it's worth $65,000. I'm embracing Jeffrey Canada's proposal for $1 billion behind promise neighborhoods. I've worked with my mentor, Hubie Jones, and Mosi Kobian on Higher Ground. They have piloted this in Boston. That's the way to get at redlining and at discrimination. So we have to have specific policies that deal with the specific injustices. And I think through this.
Thank you, Alan.
Jake?
Yes, a formal process with the institutional freight of Congress behind it to address 400 years worth of racism is overdue, and I think is going to be healthy for this country. The question here is, how do we start to make reparations to the African-American community? The core promise of this country is that the circumstances of your birth should not determine the outcome of your life. That is the core creed at the heart of our Declaration of Independence. And for 400 years, we've been failing at that to the African-American community. And there is a suite of remediation that needs to happen. I've talked about housing, talked about education, especially expanding early education. I've touched on transportation. In this Commonwealth, for example, we tell Black and Brown communities that not only does their time matter less, but actually their health matters less by the transportation infrastructure that surrounds them. And that's true in Newton, and that's true throughout the Commonwealth. We've got a lot of work to do to make sure that mobility is an engine of opportunity and not a constraint on people's health and freedom. But there's one in particular that I've often wished had gotten more airtime in the last presidential primary. Cory Booker put forward the concept of, I think he called them freedom bonds. The idea that through taxing the super wealthy, we would provide every person in this country with a small bond, a small promise that the circumstances of their birth were not going to totally dictate the outcome of their life. And that bond could be cashed in and could be realized for them to realize their potential, whether that be educational or economic. And I think that we need to start to address wealth inequality in this country through mechanisms like that. And I would look to Senator Booker, frankly, if I were in Congress, to continue to make progress on that.
Thank you, Jake. Jesse?
Absolutely yes to supporting H.R. 40. There's no question that the foundation of our country, economic, in many cases physical, was built by enslaved people who were forced to lay that foundation for us. And I think as a nation, we've failed to acknowledge that verbally and symbolically, and we have certainly failed to acknowledge and make reparations for it financially. And I would look forward to the recommendations of that commission about the ways in which those reparations should be made, whether in terms of direct payments, community investments, and to quote my friend and supporter in this race, Ayanna Pressley, the people closest to the pain should be closest to the power. And I understand that as a white woman, it will be my job to lead from behind and to listen to the BIPOC people who are identifying the ways in which reparations must be made, and to stand with them as an ally and an accomplice to make sure that we are moving forward with those recommendations after we've gone through, I'm sure what will be a lengthy and complicated process. I also know, as I mentioned earlier, that it'll be my job as a legislator to view every single piece of legislation through the lens of racial justice. And I'll give you a specific example. You know, reproductive health care is very much an issue of racial justice. When you look at rates of Black maternal mortality, when you look at the ways in which our draconian abortion care policies in this country disproportionately impact BIPOC people seeking abortion care. You know, I was the head of external affairs at Planned Parenthood here in Massachusetts and saw firsthand the ways in which our BIPOC patients were disproportionately harmed by federal policies that make healthcare outcomes worse for Black and Brown people in this country. So there are ways in which we must make reparations that will come out of the recommendations of that commission, but we have to think about the ways in which we're addressing these issues in every single policy area that crosses our desk.
Thank you, Jesse. Natalia.
Raj, obviously, since this was the same answer that I gave before, but I can go into a bit more detail. I obviously support HR 40, but I think we need to be a bit more ambitious than simply setting up a study. But what I think is really important about HR 40 is that the study would be to acknowledge what role the government played. I think too many people, you know, in the public feel like, you know, Black Americans have made bad choices. You know, we see this in the public health literature all the time where people say, well, life choices, you know, some people are obese and they eat bad food, but reparations is about acknowledging the government policies, whether we're talking about redlining, whether we're talking about the 1935 Social Security Act that excluded domestic workers and agricultural workers who were, you know, predominantly people of color, whether we're talking about the war of drugs more recently, or where, you know, policies and governments decide to put bus depots or put waste sites, you know, coal plants. Clearly, the space, the neighborhoods, you know, have been, there's been an intentional underinvestment. And so we cannot do anything without acknowledging that the responsibility therefore lies on the government to fix this intentional historic problem. And it's not just slavery. I mean, I think that is the big thing that many Americans want to say, slavery was a sin of the past, but we have seen policies continue into the very, very near present. And so I am an advocate of reparations, first of all, to acknowledge, to write, to yes, draw on, you know, the American scholars like William Darity, who are talking about this, and then to come up with a plan that works. And yes, there'll be a lot of debate as to whether we're talking about direct wealth transfers to individuals, what the timeline is, you know, are we talking about something over 20 years, 30 years? And most important to me is, when will we know we have actually come to closure, you know? And this is where I have a problem, Alan, with your idea of truth and reconciliation. Truth and reconciliation works after like a Rwanda genocide or a one-time event, but racism is ongoing. So how can we reconcile?
Elliot, thank you.
Thank you, Natalia. Becky?
Thank you.
Thank you. I absolutely support it. And a lot of very important points have been made. I wanna talk about two ways that I think are really important when we're talking about how racial justice and racial equity are inextricably linked to economic justice. And the first is how I think we need to be investing in small business, and that if we are going to make progress on this issue, we have to get serious about lifting up small business owners of color. That the data around how small business owners of color have been affected, especially in this pandemic, is dramatic. And of course, we're talking about 400 years of time and what we're seeing today, not just this pandemic, but I think it's illustrative to the point I'm trying to make, which is if you look at even how small business owners were treated in this time, they haven't had the loans they needed or the technical assistance they needed. And that's because the banking relationships that white business owners have are not there for small business owners of color. And those small business owners couldn't just call up their bank or banker to have access to capital, which I think is simply an illustration of all of the cumulative years of inequity that have played out in when we're specifically talking about this topic of small business and wealth creation through business ownership. The second is computers and internet access. Right now, we've got families who are able to have the privilege of having a device for every child and are able to have fast broadband access at home. And disproportionately in Black and Brown communities, that's not the case. How do you have distance learning if you don't have a computer at home? How do you access telehealth if you don't have an internet connection?
Thank you, Becky.
Justin?
Our next question. When contributing to a campaign, I'm going to paste that in the chat right now.
This question's specifically for Alan.
Alan, yes. When contributing to a campaign, any donation over $200 is considered a large individual contribution, an LIC. Republicans and Democrats alike, Nancy Pelosi, Ayanna Pressley, Jim Jordan, Matt Gaetz, all run on the idea that they are not supported by wealthy donors, and tellingly, they keep their LICs under 50%. Alan Casey, 95.5% of the $1.6 million that your campaign has raised comes from large individual contributions. Your donor list includes $132,500 from employees at Bain Capital, a private investment firm, $28,000 from employees at Berkshire Partners, another private equity firm, and $5,600 from Charles Ledley, who foresaw and profited from the 2007 subprime mortgage crisis. Our question is, because both money and power are consolidated by a small, very white share of the population, and big money dominates our politics, how will you balance the interests of your wealthy donors when they diverge from the interests of your Black, Brown, Latinx, and Native communities? Alan, you have a minute 30 to respond.
Well, first of all, the statistics are incorrect. I've received over 3,200 contributions, with the average, the total average is about $540. So I'm not sure where you got your data from. The contributions under $200 are not documented, but I have had hundreds, thousands of contributions from small income donors. So that's number one. Number two, I have a public career of more than 32 years fighting for social justice. I have taken positions against donors. For example, I am for repealing the carried interest law. I think that it's absurd that people who make so much money don't pay taxes on it. As Warren Buffett has said, he pays a lower tax rate than his secretary. So I have no problem. I am grateful for all the support I've gotten. People have supported me in the nonprofit work I've done at City Year and Lead the Change and Democracy Entrepreneurs. I've started 9 nonprofits, including Sister Mark Network, working with March for Our Lives. So I will have no problem. I will never. I also, 10 years ago, was among the very first candidates for Congress who said I wouldn't take any corporate PAC or lobbyist money. That was a lonely fight then. It's a litmus test now. So, and I'm also not self-funding. I'm one of the few candidates in this race who is not.
Thank you, Alan. And just to be clear, these statistics are from Open Secrets, a center for responsive politics and the nation's premier research group tracking money in politics. Jake, this next question is for you. Jake, very similarly, 95.3% of your 1.2 million comes from large individual contributions. Again, contributions over $200. Your donor list includes the chairman and CEO of Pfizer, the chairman of Bristol-Myers Squibb, and the chairman and CEO of Amgen. Pfizer, Bristol-Myers Squibb, and Amgen are some of the largest pharmaceutical companies in the world. So same question. Because both money and power are consolidated by a small, very white share of the population, and big money dominates our politics, how will you balance the interests of your wealthy donors when they diverge from the interests of your Black, Brown, Latinx, and Native constituents? You have 1 minute, 30 seconds to answer.
Well, I wouldn't balance those interests. The job of a member of Congress is not to balance the interests between wealthy donors and your constituents. The job is to represent your constituents and their needs. So there's not a balance there. It's doing your job as a member of Congress. My healthcare principles were not forged by contributions. My healthcare principles were forged around my kitchen table growing up. We're a healthcare family. My mom is a cancer scientist. My dad is Tony Fauci's number two. My brother was on the front lines of COVID response. And we talked about values, about the fact that healthcare is a human right, not a job perk. The fact that women must control their own reproductive decisions, that reproductive care is healthcare. We talked about the importance of basic medical research, about how basic medical research improves patient lives and is also a really important driver of the Massachusetts economy and creates a lot of good jobs across the Black, Brown, and white communities. So I absolutely have strong relationships with the life sciences field, and I think those strong relationships are actually important as we look to rebound in the midst of a pandemic and an economic crisis. We need a vaccine, and we need an economic recovery that includes everybody, and life sciences is going to be an important engine of both those things.
Thank you, Jake. Becky Grossman, large individual contributions make up 90.57% of your campaign contributions. Jesse Mermel, large individual contributions make up 83.31% of your contributions. And Hassan Leki, you have personally funded 83.92% of your campaign's funds, a portion partially derived from your husband's work at Boston Energy Trading and Marketing, a company that works with the coal and fossil fuel industry. This asks the question, Becky, Jesse, and Hassan, how will you manage the outsized influence of wealthy Americans when their interests diverge from those of Black, Brown, Latinx, and Native communities? Becky, Jesse, and Hassan, you will have 1 minute to respond. And Becky, we will start with you. Oh, and I'll unmute you right now. Sorry about that.
Thank you. So I'm running for Congress through the lens of a mom who is fed up by what is going on in this country and determined to make change.
I am going to look at each and every issue through that lens of what is going to protect our kids and our families today and long into the future and for generations to come, period. I am not taking corporate PAC money. I am not taking fossil fuel money. I do not believe that anything should control the lens through which I'm looking at the issues other than what is in the immediate and long-term best interest of our community and certainly communities of color and an anti-racist lens. There is no donor, corporate special interest, or lobbyist who is ever going to convince me to sell out our kids or their future, period.
Thank you, Becky. Jesse?
You know, I'm incredibly proud that we've received over 4,000 donations, average contribution about $225. We're not taking money from corporate PACs. We're not taking money from the fossil fuel industry, certainly not fueled by personal wealth. We are people powered. And I talk about not just my commitment to advancing BIPOC residents of the 4th Congressional District, but the work that I have been doing in this space for over 20 years. There isn't a single donor giving $1 or all the way up to the maximum who doesn't know that that has been the work of my career and the work that I'll continue when I am in Congress. I'm also proud to have led in this field on transparency, releasing 6 years of my personal tax returns, something we aren't required to do because I want voters to know that I'm running a campaign rooted in transparency and accountability, and that the only people I am going to be accountable to and beholden to are the voters of the 4th Congressional District.
Hassan?
So I need to set the record straight. So I'm asking for the additional 20 seconds if it is available. First of all, saying that the money that I donated to the campaign in a time where it's COVID-19, in a time where our small donors lost their jobs and lost their health insurance, is sexist to say that that money is from my husband's money. That is sexist. So let's deal with that first. Second, to set the record straight, my husband has nothing to do with fossil fuels. He works in the transmission side of things. We know that the energy atoms, you cannot determine where they come from. He works to make sure that there are no blackouts, that the transmission is happening no matter how high the demand is in different parts of our country. That's how he makes his earnings. I made my earnings from the Federal Reserve fighting for the most vulnerable, fighting the biggest Wall Street banks, fighting corruption on Wall Street. And I'm so proud to be the only candidate in this race who does not take a dime from corporate PACs or lobbyists, who is not supported by the...
Thank you, Hassan. And those words, the partially derived, was from the Brookline for Racial Justice and Equity Forum.
Okay, Angelica. Thank you. I think we're going to go back to everybody answering. Health issues that lower both life expectancy and quality of life, including HIV, terminal cancers, diabetes, and childhood obesity, disproportionately affect the African American and Indigenous communities. While coverage expansions under the ACA, the Affordable Care Act, have hastened the progress toward universal coverage, the continued high cost of many coverage options means that access to affordable healthcare is still a challenge for many Americans, particularly African Americans and Indigenous people. What specifically, focusing on the African American and Indigenous community, does your healthcare plan do to rectify this disparity, broaden the coverage, and enhance the quality of coverage? Each candidate will have 2 minutes to respond. Natalia, we will start with you.
Thanks so much, Angelica. And I'm one of the few candidates who, actually, there's three of us who believe in Medicare for all. And I believe that that is fundamentally how we have to move forward. You know, health is a human right. And we have seen that too many Americans are uninsured or underinsured. And the disproportionate impacts that you're talking about, you know, HIV, life expectancy, diabetes, play out in part because of access to healthcare, but as a social epidemiologist, I also want to make sure that we are clear that our health is shaped also by the conditions in which we live, where we love, where we play, where we go to school, our neighborhoods. So we have to fix fundamentally our healthcare system, and I would fight for Medicare for All, but to really, really, really get rid of the health disparities that you're talking about, we also need to fix all the other systems, our housing, our education, our environmental justice issues. So specifically, what are the things I would fight for? Number one, ensuring that, you know, we have the same quality of care for different communities. And, you know, we have seen that that's not the case. We have seen rural hospitals and places that serve, you know, Indigenous and other communities being understaffed, underserved. So quality is an issue. We have to ensure that the quality of care also, you know, part of the challenge why you see maternal mortality rates being so much higher for Black moms is that they receive different care within the maternity ward. You know, so some of the bills that have been put forward to ensure that moms can have a doula at their side to advocate for them, to push for better outcomes. The other types of issues, though, that we need to think about is public health and is ensuring that mental health and other services are equally met. And beyond the healthcare system, we need to talk about paid sick leave. You know, white Americans and managers are 90% have paid sick leave, but for the most working class and.
Thank you.
Becky?
Well, for starters, the healthcare inequities that we have seen among Black Americans during the pandemic should come as a surprise to none of us here, because Black and Brown people have had worse health outcomes for so long because we have provided inadequate care and we've provided inadequate access. I believe that healthcare is a human right, and that we should get everybody covered in a quality, affordable way as quickly as possible. This is personal for me. My mother, almost 5 years ago, went from being healthy and vibrant and active one day to being incredibly sick the next. And it turned out she was diagnosed with a rare autoimmune disease, and that we've been in and out of more hospitals than I care to count, and that I've been by my parents' side as they have tried to navigate our incredibly fractured healthcare system. My underlying value here is to get everyone covered as quickly as possible in an affordable quality way. To my mind, the way to do that is through a public option on the way to Medicare for All, because that is something that is achievable right away. Families are in crisis now. We need to get them the coverage now, and I am prepared to work with President Joe Biden to get that done. And then I think we need to talk about all of the other elements of health and what makes for a healthy life. And that includes housing justice, climate justice, economic justice. And I hope that we're gonna be able to continue to get into those elements of health as well, because a roof over your head, clean air, clean water, green space, these are all parts of what a healthy life is.
Thank you, Jake.
There are three I want to focus on in the healthcare field. One is paid family medical leave, and also the cousin to paid family medical leave, which is more stable scheduling for hourly employees. I think that erratic scheduling, I think the data shows that erratic scheduling is really detrimental to family life and disproportionately affects Black and Brown workers. And not only do you need to be able to secure people's ability to spend time with their family in the ups and downs of their life, but on a week-to-week basis, people need the stability and the mental health that comes with knowing when you're going to be working, when you're not going to be working. And that ties into childcare. That ties into just basically the foundation of a stable well-being. Second is that we need to introduce the concept of pre-existing liabilities into our healthcare coverage mandate. We have the idea of pre-existing conditions, and that obviously needs to be part of any process going forward. But increasingly, we have one-time treatments that actually cure disease, but they're getting harder and harder to pay for because insurance companies are refusing to accept pre-existing liabilities that come from a high sticker price to treat, you know, cystic fibrosis with a one-time treatment. That needs to be mandated that if you change insurance companies because you're changing jobs, that liability transfers with you and the new insurance company has to cover it. That's going to be important to both life sciences innovation and to curing diseases that we can conquer, but that we need the right incentives in place to do. And then finally is Alzheimer's research. We need a national moonshot to cure Alzheimer's. The care for people with cognitive decline disproportionately falls on women. It also disproportionately falls on Black and Brown women. If we can cure Alzheimer's, we can prevent the increasing pincer movement that's crushing the sandwich generation of women who are taking care of both young dependents, their children at home, but also their parents and in-laws who are going into cognitive decline. That is going to be an incredibly important driver of quality of life and of economic opportunity going forward.
Thank you. Asan?
Intertwined. Oh, right. Hi. Our healthcare system is intertwined with every other part of life. I've been an advocate for Medicare for All since before running for the seat. I organized 3 months of phone banking in our district to urge our own congressman to vote for it. And I saw in the stories that I heard from people on the phone how they too have lost a loved one because of the healthcare injustice, like I did. I lost my father at age 13 because we couldn't afford his medication. And so we have to start to look from that lens, that when we lose a loved one who has been the main provider of the food on the table, what are the implications on that family? Their housing, if they live in public housing, like here in Brookline, and they have mold, their children are getting sick with asthma. Their children are getting sick with asthma. They're not able to go to school on time. They're missing out on education. They're missing out on economic opportunity. It's a connected system. And so when we talk about healthcare, we have to talk about it as if our lives demand it right now. We can't go into a longer process that costs us more lives and more bankruptcy in our families.
Thank you. Alan?
Healthcare family. My mother was a nurse anesthetist and a school nurse. My father was a surgeon, a cancer specialist, and a vascular surgeon. But it became really real for me after our daughter was born. 3 days after her birth, the doctors and nurses told us that she had a serious heart condition called tetralogy of Fallot. We didn't know what it meant. They said she'd have to have emergency heart surgery within 6 weeks, which she did. Thankfully, we had good health coverage and we had access to Children's Hospital and they saved her life. She then had to have another emergency heart surgery when she was 13 and she started fainting. And again, Children's Hospital saved her life. So this is very personal. It is a human right. I believe that we should build off of the Affordable Care Act with a strong public option. I advocated for this 11 years ago so that anybody who can't afford it gets it for free. I believe that we should be able to get the money out of politics and negotiate prescription drug costs. It's 10 cents on the dollar in Canada. We are the biggest buyer, and we can save hundreds of billions of dollars, and we could use that to pay for the public option. I also think that the coronavirus, as you mentioned, is showing us the deep disparities in our healthcare system, and we have to now move from a concept of individual insurance to a concept of public health insurance. We have to treat obesity, diabetes. We have to educate kids in schools. We have to understand that our healthcare is all connected. We also need to deal with the issue of mental health and take it out of the shadows. I have teenagers, 60% of our teenagers are suffering from severe anxiety and depression, yet you can't get coverage for that, or if you do, it's hard to get it reimbursed. We also have to understand the other public health issues like gun violence and Juul smoking, etc. So I will commit to this, and when we started City Year, we actually gave everyone premium-free healthcare from the beginning. And because we were the model for AmeriCorps, AmeriCorps has now given 1.1 million people healthcare. So.
Thank you, Alan.
Ben?
Yes, look, I wanna make sure that one thing is clear, that as one, if not the only candidate of everyone in this race right now, who is not self-funding with significant wealth, or is not being supported by super PACs created by their friends and family, I am the only candidate that's amplifying voices and not trying to buy your vote. How ironic is it that I'm only also the only Latino in this race that can't self-fund or have friends and family that can create super PACs? Let's just be very clear about that. In terms of the healthcare though, absolutely we need paid family and medical leave immediately, both an emergency under COVID-19, but overall we can't be the only industrialized country in the world not to have it. We also need to be able to have the federal government negotiate prescription drug prices under Medicare. This is extremely important. It will save us over $500 billion over 10 years. And we need to make sure we're not discriminating against pre-existing conditions that are being created by our environment, because we know that our Black and brown communities are the holding the biggest burden of the climate crisis. We need to combat environmental racism and injustice. We also have to make sure that our Black communities especially have access to quality food. We also need to make sure that everyone has access to equal care. We know under COVID-19, our Black communities are contracting COVID-19 at double and triple their rates of their population. They are getting tested less, they're getting treated less. We also need to make sure that we collect and provide racial data on who is getting tested and who is getting treated. And finally, I agree with a few of the other candidates that talked about we're only in this because we need to also fix our housing system, our transportation system, our criminal justice system. It's all connected to our healthcare. As a Puerto Rican with a community that has high asthma rates, I can see this personally and I feel it personally.
Thank you, Ben. Jesse.
So there's no question that fixing our failing, broken healthcare system isn't the only thing that we need to do in order to improve health outcomes for our BIPOC friends and neighbors, but it's a big piece of the puzzle. You know, I've worked for two direct service healthcare providers, Planned Parenthood League of Massachusetts, and I ran the Mass Association for the Blind and Visually Impaired. Two very different population sets, but working with some of the most vulnerable people among us to make sure they have access to healthcare. It's why I'm a strong supporter of Medicare for All. Just like, by the way, every member of the federal delegation who represents the 4th Congressional District, just like about 75% of Democratic primary voters in this district. And one of the big reasons that I support Medicare for All is because of the ways in which it will help us address the racial disparities in our healthcare system. And I'll drill down on two pieces of that. I already talked a little bit about disparities in our reproductive healthcare system, the negative outcomes we're seeing for Black and brown mothers and maternal mortality outcomes. It's also about access to abortion care. It's about the ways in which Donald Trump is taking money from Title X family planning meant to help low-income people seeking reproductive health care, particularly Black and brown people, and sending that to things like crisis pregnancy centers that just hurt communities of color when people are seeking care. Those are the type of policies that my healthcare plan seeks to advance to directly address the disparities on the ground that people are facing. I also want to lift up mental health care and the importance of that in Medicare for All. We know that BIPOC people seeking healthcare are less likely to have access to mental health care. And when they are able to access it, they're more likely to terminate care prematurely because of a lack of cultural competency or an inability to pay. We need things like Medicare for All to make sure that mental health care, which is a fundamental part of healthcare, period, are readily available to everyone who needs it. I'm really proud to be endorsed by frontline healthcare workers in this race, to have the support of the Mass Nurses Association, SEIU.
Thank you, Jesse.
All right, the next question we've already kind of alluded to. I'm excited. Americans have been locked up for minor drug infractions like possession of marijuana and subsequently had many rights taken away, including voting rights. Bill Clinton and Joe Biden passed tough on crime laws in the 1990s that exacerbated this issue, especially for the Black community. In contrast, the Trump administration passed the First Step Act, which delivered much overdue prison reforms. His rhetoric aside, President Trump and his supporters claim that his actions have delivered more to the Black community than Clinton and Biden. How would you respond? And what specifically would you do for the hundreds of thousands of Americans, disproportionately Black and Latinx, still serving unfair prison sentences? Each candidate will have 2 minutes to respond. Ben, we will start with you.
Yes, thank you for this such important question. I mean, to even hear Trump talk about anything in terms of prison is just ridiculous. Look, we know this. The United States has 5% of the total population in the world and 25% of the prisoner population. Mass incarceration is an enormous issue here. And marijuana is a key driver of mass incarceration. So we need to talk about what are we going to do to make sure people aren't getting into jail, and then what do we do with people who get into jail? So clearly, we need to repeal mandatory minimum sentences. We for non drug-related offenses. We need to eliminate cash bail. We need to legalize marijuana. But we need to work on engagement and education. We need to put treatment, can't be subordinate to punishment. So we have to decriminalize poverty, decriminalize mental health, decriminalize a substance use disorder. These are all really, really important. And we need to put more people on the front lines who are social workers, youth engagement counselors, sociologists, psychologists, you name it, they need to be there, not our police on the front lines. So that's number one. But look, if you do end up going to jail, and if you do have to serve your time, then we have to work on three different things. Making sure we don't have a recidivism problem, which is 45% of people go into jail, return back into the prison system. We need a rehabilitation part, and we need skills and training. On recidivism, we need to make sure when people are in jail, when they leave, there is a social safety net for them. They have the housing that they need, the healthcare that they need, they have the skills and tools that they need to succeed. If they have substance use disorder or mental health challenges, we need to give them the treatment so that we can help with their different issues before they come. And finally, they need the skills and training for jobs so they can have high quality jobs and get higher quality wages so they're not going to be back in prison after.
Thank you. Jesse?
The racial inequities baked into our criminal legal system are a stain on this country, and we need to be clear that they were created by policy choices made by generation after generation of leaders in this country, rooted in 400 years of systemic racism. That means we have the opportunity, the responsibility to make different choices and lead to different outcomes. We absolutely need to end mass incarceration, end the cradle to prison pipeline. I support Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley's People's Justice Guarantee. I support ending for-profit prisons and making sure that we're ending qualified immunity, abolishing the death penalty, eliminating life without the opportunity for parole, ending cash bail. There is so much that we have to do. I want to make sure we're also addressing the trauma that exists in communities because of the failures around our criminal legal system, failure that exists even if you yourself haven't been engaged in the criminal legal system because of the broad impact of this trauma in communities. We need to make sure that we are doing so much more than reforming the system itself. It's about engaging with communities to address that lasting systemic trauma. We need to legalize marijuana at the federal level. We need to expunge records for those who have been impacted by the war on drugs. And we need to make sure that we are holding law enforcement accountable when they violate people's civil rights and engage in police brutality. I'm proud to have an A rating from Defund Newton Police, to have signed their pledge, and to be working with those remarkable student activists and young people in Newton who are leading the way on this.
Thank you. Jake?
I remember when I went into Marine Officer Candidate School, we had a trio of sergeants who were our instructors. And one of them in particular, I still remember to this day, he was one of the most professional, competent mentors I've ever had in my life. He was tough at the time, obviously, but truly someone I think of as a role model. And he told us a story at the end of training where in his as 15, 16, 17 year old, he kept on making mistakes. He'd gotten into some trouble. And he went in front of a judge, and the judge finally said to him, "You got two choices. I'm gonna send you to prison, or you can enlist in the Marine Corps and see if you can start fresh." And he took the second option, and he made a great career for himself as a Marine. Now, he was white. And I think the hard question we have to ask ourselves as a country is, if he had been a black teenager, would he have gotten that chance from a judge? And I think the hard answer we have to give ourselves is no, he would not have. Our criminal justice system is racist. We need a decarceration initiative in this country that examines current sentences that have been passed under the war on drugs, because nobody should be serving serious prison time or any prison time for minor drug offenses. It's just not appropriate, not a good use of resources, and it's certainly not a good way for them to spend their lives. It's not fair. And then we also need to demilitarize the police. Since 9/11 in this country, we've had an inversion where we have increasingly asked our military to police people overseas in two failed forever wars, disproportionately sending black and brown young men and women overseas, I'll add, while at the same time asking our police and intelligence services here at home to police the public square in an increasingly militarized capacity that breaks community bonds. We have got to have a police force that is part of the fabric of the community, that is organic to the community, and is not an occupying force in the community.
Thank you. Alan?
This is another one of Trump's completely outrageous claims. More than 170,000 people have unnecessarily lost their lives due to the coronavirus because he refused to take it seriously. The vast majority are Black and brown and low-income people of color. So no, he hasn't done anything for this community. Here's what we need to do. I put out a comprehensive criminal justice proposal back in March. I'm very familiar with the school to prison pipeline because we started working in the Blackstone School in the South End, and I saw it then, and I've been working in inner city schools ever since. You know, young 5 and 6 year olds, little boys who are targeted and suspended because people can't figure out how to educate them. I propose that we should make sure that anybody who's been put in for a marijuana offense should be released now. I propose that we should end private prisons. It's insidious that companies are making money off of keeping people in jail. We should end 3 strikes, you're out. We should give judges and mandatory minimums, give judges the discretion. We have more Black men in prison today, 729,000, than were enslaved in 1820. This is an abomination. I propose that we should restore voting rights for formerly incarcerated people. We should give them access to Pell Grants. We should pay them minimum wage when they're working in prisons as opposed to using them as just cheap labor. We need to have a fundamental overhaul of our, we don't have a criminal justice system. We have a criminal revenge system, and we have to understand that. I've also proposed that we have to make sure that we are doing the investments, that we are making sure that we don't have 1 in 3 Black men ensnared in the prison system, and rather having more people being able to access the American dream, access college. We have to take this very seriously. It's a history of our history of systemic racism, and there's a lot we can do. And I will fight hard to make sure we get it done and that we build a coalition so that we finally take on the scourge in our country.
Thank you. Natalia?
Angelica, thanks so much for this question. And I already referenced the war on drugs and sort of tough on crime and our failure. You know, I think our mass incarceration system shows how systemic racism plays out, from over-policing to, you know, how sentencing is unequal to, you know, what happens when you're there. I agree with a lot of what has been said in terms of ending cash bail, in terms of no, you know, private prisons, in terms of sentencing reform, you know, getting rid of, you know, federally the marijuana, sort of making it legal. But I wanted to highlight something that hasn't been talked about, is improving the conditions for those already incarcerated. That has come up front and center in COVID because prison populations have been hit really hard. So I was part of many groups as part of my role as executive director of a center at Harvard on health and human rights, calling for decarceration, calling for people to be released immediately. And beyond that, you know, even if you don't think about COVID, while I worked at the New York City Health Department, we pushed to end the use of solitary confinement. We failed. It is one of the most horrific things that I think we do, is how we treat the populations that are incarcerated. So those attention to that has to be paid as well. Finally, we need to pay attention to reintegration. You know, the reality is that reintegration means ensuring people have voting rights, have employment and housing, they don't need to check the box, ensuring that we reduce recidivism by stopping parole. You know, most people end up back in prison because of technical violations, not because of a crime they committed. So we need to understand that our system is broken across the entire continuum, from policing practices within, you know, bail reform that is needed within prisons, and then later our system of how we reintegrate. And a systemic review of that is what we need right now. And I would be pushing for that. And on your question of, you know, Bill Clinton, it's, I mean, we do need to admit that Democratic administration.
Thank you.
Thank you. Asan?
Thank you. So yeah, as I mentioned before, you know, I am a huge supporter of legalizing marijuana across the country and making sure that we have expungement, getting people who were who are losing their lives in prison right now to get out of there, and giving them the economic opportunity and the reparations to make up for that loss, economically at least. But here's the thing. Anything that comes out of Trump is not something that I would trust to begin with. And whether we have Biden this time or whether we have Trump is in our hands, right? We can work really hard to get Trump out of office so that we can win back our democracy and we can pass all these policies that we're talking about, most of which are on my website. So the problem that we face is, again, going back to representation and to corporate money in politics. I'm the only woman of color in this race. It's really in the people's hands to choose and decide out of this wonderful field of candidates whether we want different representation so that we can bring people with the lived experiences who reflect the needs of our communities. But also, let's not forget that corporate money in politics is corrosive. It's why we have private prisons. It's why we have mass incarceration. It's why we have racism in our policies that has not been dealt with. It's why we have police brutality. It's why we have killings like of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor. And so look, I'm proud to be endorsed by Congresswoman Ilhan Omar, who's leading the charge on racial justice in Congress right now. And I look forward to working with her on the many policies we will be pushing together with zero corporate money. Thank you.
Thank you. And Becky.
Others have already spoken to incredibly important reforms that I believe in passionately, such as eliminating or reforming cash bail, in reforming how sentencing works, in ending private prisons, and other incredibly important tenets of criminal justice reform. I want to speak about the importance of an opportunity that we are missing by the time that somebody finds themselves in a criminal courtroom. And that is that we have an opportunity to help people turn their life around and offer mental health and social services, and we don't. We are missing that opportunity. By the time someone finds themselves in that criminal courtroom, especially at the district court level, we know we have long ago failed them, and that is a moment where we can step in, offer services, offer support, offer rehabilitation, offer treatment, and help that individual to turn their life around. And that is something that I'm going to fight for in Congress. And I also want to speak to the importance of reforming policing in this country, because systemic racism includes racism in policing in every community in this country. And that's why I believe in demilitarizing the police and ending qualified immunity, in a full federal ban on chokeholds, and on forming civilian review boards to do the hard work of looking line by line at how we spend money on policing, and designing and being honest about what actually would make people safe and actually feel safe. And then figure out how.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, so we are going to ask our final question. To conclude the Democrat town hall, what makes you uniquely qualified amongst this group of candidates to take the fight of racial equity and systemic racism to Washington, D.C.? Each candidate will have 2 minutes to respond. Jesse, we will start with you.
Well, first, thank you so much for the opportunity to be with you tonight. To everyone who organized and to everyone tuning in, I know you don't need another hour plus of Zoom in your life at this point. Listen, I'm the proven progressive in this race. I've spent 20 years fighting for racial, social, and economic justice, and I have the track record to prove it. You know, leading fights at Planned Parenthood to tackle racial inequity in our reproductive healthcare system, working leading the state's progressive business organization to deliver on policy proposals that tackle the economic disparities facing BIPOC people in the 4th Congressional District and beyond, paid family and medical leave, raising the minimum wage, earned sick time, raising revenue equitably to invest in education and transportation, leading on issues like climate change when I was a select board member in Brookline. I have the results and the track record to prove not just my commitment to these issues, but the fact that I can deliver. I'm proud to have built the broadest, most diverse grassroots coalition in this race, to have the endorsement of leaders like Ayanna Pressley, Diane Patrick, Maura Healey, Suzanne Bump, organizations representing remarkably diverse constituencies like the Coalition for Social Justice, SEIU, Mass Teachers Association, Mass Nurses Association, 21 different labor unions. We're not funded by corporate PAC money. We're not funded by the fossil fuel industry, not funded by personal wealth. Like I said earlier, we're people powered. And that's why you're seeing the progressive community, the social justice community, rally around our campaign here in the last 2 weeks to fight to make sure that in one of the bluest districts in the country, we have a progressive in that seat. We have someone with a commitment and a track record around racial justice, social justice, and tackling inequity in all of its forms. I hope I've demonstrated to you tonight that I'm the candidate to fight for you in Washington, to deliver on what we need in these challenging times in this district. And I ask for your vote on or before September 1st.
Thank you. Ihsan?
Thank you. You know, being a woman of color is not just about the color of my skin. This is about my lived experiences. This is about realizing what it means to be a person of color in America when it wasn't something that I grew up in. I was canvassing in one of the most conservative areas in Texas for a Democrat. And this woman came so close to me and said, "Where are you from?" And I said, "I'm American." And she said, "Yeah, but your skin is dark. What's your nationality?" And that's when I realized that the rights and the opportunities afforded to people in America are not the same. That being a shade darker takes away your opportunities. And I couldn't imagine what that means for our Black and Indigenous communities. So look, this job needs somebody who can bring people together. This is not about the resume. This is not about the endorsements. This is not about any of that. I have fought the biggest bets on Wall Street. I hope you don't take that as a sign, but look, I have fought the biggest banks on Wall Street. And I understand that their greed is what's between us and the American dream. It's what's between us and eliminating racism in our systems. And so I'm ready to fight against them. And I'm ready to bring my lived experiences to every part of the policy making. And I can't wait to earn your vote and to be your Congresswoman starting September 1st. Thank you.
Thank you. Jake?
As a Marine officer, I was able to work with, lead, take orders from Black and brown and white Marines in a common mission in Afghanistan and in Panama. And that experience of setting aside differences and uniting for a common purpose is a realization of what we can do in this country when we have leadership and when we have a sense of a vision of what can be achieved. As a city councilor in Newton, I have forged progressive coalitions to make real progress on housing and transportation and the environment, issues that have outsized impact on Black and brown communities. I'm proud that I have of the support of the most progressive members of the Newton City Council and of housing and civil rights advocates, because they've seen me in action for 5 years. And they know what I can do, and they know the impact that I can have on opportunity and on racial justice. When the Boston Globe endorsed my candidacy, they said I was best prepared of this field to represent a district of haves and have-nots. This district is diverse. It's diverse across multiple dimensions. And what it takes is someone, first, who has the toughness to take on Trump and dismantle the Trump agenda, but second, who can forge coalitions for the day after Trump leaves, so that we have an inclusive economic recovery where every family has a living wage and a dignified retirement, and where we're making meaningful progress on healthcare, education, transportation, and climate change. This all requires coalitions, and this all requires leadership. And I've demonstrated both in my career, both in the Marines and in the City Council. So I'd ask those who are watching tonight to join the Boston Globe, to join the mayor of Fall River, the mayor of New Bedford, half the City Council in Newton, and multiple other local leaders across the district in supporting my candidacy and voting for me on or before September 1st.
Thank you, Jake. Becky.
Thank you so much for having me tonight. I am running for Congress with the fierce urgency of a mom fed up by what is going on in this country and determined to make change. And I wake up every day thinking about how we are going to protect the long-term best interest for working families, for our kids, and how we are going to protect them for generations to come. Right now, out of 435 members of Congress, we only have 25 who are mothers of school-aged children. I think that if we had 100 or 200 moms of young kids in Congress, we could change the conversation in Washington completely. Imagine what we could get done on providing quality, affordable health care for everyone in this country. Imagine how we could tackle the climate emergency and make sure that the generations to come have a planet to live on. Imagine how we could guarantee paid family and medical leave, how we could implement universal pre-K and guarantee quality, affordable childcare for every family in this country. That is the passion and urgency and commitment that I am going to bring to Congress. I ask for your vote, and I thank you again for the opportunity to be with you this evening.
Thank you, Alan.
After Trump was elected, one of the very first things he said he would do was the Muslim ban. He followed that up with 4 years of attacks on the most vulnerable and marginalized people in our country. The LGBTQ plus community, the immigrant community, the black and brown community, women, and the most evil thing he's done is to separate children from their families and put them in cages at the border. As a parent, I'm just appalled by that. I can't imagine somebody separating my children, and those children will never be reunited with their parents. When he issued the Muslim ban, it was very personal for me because I realized that if my dad were coming to this country now, someone who left a dictatorship inspired by a country of freedom, he would be banned. Everyone in the Iranian side of my family has been banned. It's one of the reasons I got involved in the Women's March, because I wanted to do something and help to build the Sister March Network. My father passed 3 years ago. I miss him every single day. But I'm glad that he didn't live to see what Trump has done to this country. It would break his heart. If I'm elected, I will be the first ever Iranian American elected to the United States Congress. My community has led everywhere but in politics because people are afraid. They feel the prejudice. If I'm elected, I will take the movement skill building skills that I've demonstrated over 30 years. I worked to build the service movement. I helped to pass 3 federal laws that have enabled 1.1 million people to serve in this country, coming together from all backgrounds. When Tom DeLay tried to kill it, I saved it, and I beat Mitch McConnell. I will fight every day to build an intersectional coalition to overturn Trump's hatred and division and restore America as the country of love, of faith, of intersectionality, and most of all, justice. That is my commitment. Thank you.
Thank you. Matt Talia?
Angelica, we're in the midst of a global pandemic, the worst that our country has ever seen. And early on in the pandemic, I knew that it would play out unequally, disproportionately, harming communities of color. So on day one, when we had just one death, I wrote a piece in the Washington Post saying that unless we took an equity lens to the pandemic, we would see hundreds and thousands of Americans of color losing their lives. I joined Reverend Barber. He asked me to join his committee for the Poor People's Campaign to serve on his Health Justice Advisory Committee. I wrote a piece in Foreign Affairs saying that we should not be policing public health. We should not be pulling people off buses. This was before George Floyd's murder, but calling attention to the over-policing of Black and Brown communities. And then it hit me that I couldn't be sitting on the sidelines and just be calling on the government. The most direct way for me to make an impact today was to step into this race. I'm a mom of a 7-year-old and 3-year-old twins. That decision was not easy, but it felt urgent. I'm the only one here who has public health expertise, the only one who has worked at the global stage. I worked at the United Nations for 10 years, and this is a global pandemic. And President Trump decided to defund the World Health Organization in the middle of such a crisis. this crisis, this pandemic, this failure is happening because it's playing out disproportionately on Black and brown bodies. That is why we haven't had the action that we need. As someone who has worked on racial justice, someone who has committed her career to health equity, I have stepped into this race and I will ensure that COVID, not only the response, but also the recovery is an equitable one. I am the best candidate because I'm the only candidate that has that science background, that has that expertise, that has worked with governments on challenges such as this one, and it felt necessary. I honestly would not have stepped in if these were normal circumstances, but we are not in normal circumstances, and who is being harmed the most is our communities of color, and therefore I am here to serve, and I hope that before September 1st or by September 1st, you will vote for the scientist. You will vote for the someone who is not a typical political candidate. My endorsements.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, Ben.
Thank you. And thank you so much again to the Franklin Area Against Racism for putting tonight's forum together, and especially for Franklin, which is near and dear to my heart because my brother and my niece and my nephew live in Franklin. Now look, I am the only candidate who day one on their platform, as part of their platform, had combating hatred, racism, and anti-Semitism in all forms against all people. I'm not just talking about it now like a lot of the other candidates because it's convenient since COVID-19 started or since the murder of George Floyd. I've been talking about it because I've lived through it and I've had a major part in helping to eradicate hatred and racism in our country. Look, it's more important than ever right now that we elect a diverse leader who truly understands the diverse perspectives of our communities, racially, geographically, economically. And it's really important that we don't have a leader who just tells you they're going to combat racism to buy your vote, but actually someone like myself who's been advancing diversity, equity, and inclusion for years. We need a leader who's a unifier, a bridge builder, a connector. I've been the president of the Hispanic National Bar Association for the last 2 years. I've sat on the Diversity and Inclusion Committee at my law firm and on the Boston Bar Association. I have been named one of the 50 most influential attorneys of color in Boston and one of the 100 most influential people of Boston. It is time that we don't pick a candidate who's going to buy your vote, and especially one who comes from an undiverse, privileged background. We need a leader who is going to listen to you, who's going to understand you, who's going to stand with you, and who's going to amplify the voice of everyone in this district and not just the privileged few. Please go to our website at bensiegelforcongress.com, and I hope to have your vote to become the first Latino ever elected to Congress from Massachusetts. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you to all of the candidates for participating in our town hall today. Our Republican candidate, David Rosa, has not joined. So we will conclude this town hall at this point. Thank you to our audience for joining us. We hope that this town hall has been helpful and makes your decision at the ballot box easier. Please visit all the candidates' websites for more information and make sure you make informed decisions up and down the ballot.
And before you go, if you have requested a mail-in ballot or absentee ballot, please send it in as early as possible. If you have not already registered to vote for this primary election, need to change your address, or just want to check your registration information, please visit sec.state.ma.us. You can also vote in person on September 1st or sooner with early voting. If you wish to vote early, please search that sec.state.ma early voting in Google for locations and dates. Thank you also to our audience members for joining us this evening, and good night.
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 Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good night. Night.
We are now producing this in collaboration with Franklin TV and Franklin Public Radio, WFPR-FM. This podcast is my public service effort for Franklin, but we can't do it alone. We can always use your help. How can you help? If you can use the information you find here, please tell your friends and neighbors. If you don't like something here, please let me know. Through this feedback loop, we can continue to make improvements. And I thank you for listening. For additional information, please visit franklinmatters.org. If you have questions or comments, you can reach me directly at suresteve@gmail.com.
The music for the intro and exit was provided by Michael Clark and the group East of Shirley. The piece is titled Ernesto Mañana. Copyright Michael Clark and Tin Type Tunes and used with their permission. I hope you enjoy. You can also subscribe and listen to Franklin Matters Radio on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. Search in podcasts for Franklin Matters.